content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today is entitled The Dizzying Contrast of Trump's Iran Threats and Artemis II, written by Charlie Warzel. And this is a regular newsletter feature of his. Seeing the Earth from space will change you so profoundly that there's a term for it, the overview effect. The extreme minority who have had the privilege describe it similarly. You see something that you were never meant to see, namely the Earth just sitting there, with the entire universe surrounding it. Gazing upon the blue marble, surrounded by its oh-so-thin green layer of atmosphere, the auroras flickering on the fringes, is not merely awe-inspiring, but something of a factory reset for one's sense of self. Almost everyone tears up at the sight. You don't see borders. You don't see religious lines. You don't see political boundaries. All you see is Earth, and you see that we are way more alike than we are different. Christina Koch, one of the four astronauts on the Artemis II mission, told NASA recently. Jim Lovell, describing the view on Apollo 8 from the dark side of the moon back in the late 1960s, told Chicago magazine that he could put his thumb up to the window, and in that moment, everything I ever knew was behind it. Billions of people, oceans, mountains, deserts, and I began to wonder, where do I fit into what I see? Where some see immeasurable beauty, others see fragility. Marina Corin previously reported in this magazine that, upon seeing the Earth from space, one astronaut became absolutely convinced we would kill ourselves off between 500 and 1,000 years from now. Famously, the actor William Shatner had written that his brief experience looking at the Earth produced a profound sadness. What I was feeling was grief, and the grief was for the Earth, he told Corin in 2022. I've never been to space, but for the past few days, I've oscillated between these emotions, awe and despair, as NASA has continued to post photos of the Earth and Moon from Artemis II. Yesterday, the Integrity spacecraft came within 4,067 miles of the Moon during its lunar flyby. For 40 minutes, it lost all contact with humanity. At one point, they were 252,756 miles away from Earth, the furthest from the planet anyone has ever traveled. For 7 hours, the astronauts, Koch, Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, and Jeremy Hansen, were able to gaze upon a part of the lunar surface previously unseen by human eyes. According to NASA, the astronauts took roughly 10,000 photos, which feels perfectly proportional for such an occasion. A few of these photos, some taken before the lunar pass, have messed me up pretty good. A photo of the Earth appearing to set behind the Moon. A picture taken through a window of the Orion spacecraft revealing the tiniest crescent Earth growing smaller as the capsule heads towards the Moon. As one caption on the photo notes, the Earth is illuminated by the blackness of space. I've experienced these photos the way I experience most media, through the puny screen of my phone, with the awesome life-affirming images sandwiched between updates about a golf tournament, oil prices, the MLB's new automated ball strike system, and reports of the U.S. president threatening civilizational destruction of Iran. On a good day, a good calm day, it is hard to know what to make of photos that show, in no uncertain terms, that every single thing you will ever and could ever know is simultaneously galactically insignificant and unspeakably beautiful and precious. Today the world held its breath, waiting for the 8 p.m. Eastern deadline Trump set for Iran to agree to a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. If his terms weren't met, he posted this morning, a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. Trump's threats triggered denouncements from Democratic lawmakers, as well as the podcasters Tucker Carlson and Alex Jones, and incited no small amount of panic from people who have interpreted Trump's post as a suggestion of nuclear warfare. Then this evening, an hour before the deadline, Trump announced a two-week ceasefire deal, which Pakistan helped broker. Trump's bluster, no matter how serious, has always been impossible to parse. He's famous for chickening out, backpedaling, or pretending like he never said what he said. Yet one way to view our current age is as a series of existential reminders, be they nuclear proliferation, climate change, or pandemics. In Silicon Valley over the past half decade, civilizational extinction at the hands of hypothetical technological advances has moved from the realm of pure science fiction to a marketing tactic to an immediate concern for a subset of true believers. Humans may not want to die, but as a species we seem eager to invent and tout new ways to threaten our existence. And yet at the very same moment, four flesh and blood human beings are hundreds of thousands of miles away taking pictures of our delicate little world. Their mission and their photos remind us of something else entirely, of a yearning to learn, to explore, and to band together to become something greater than the sum of our parts. If Trump's claims of mass destruction represent humanity at its smallest, weakest, and most cowardly, then those who are gazing upon our planet right now from afar represent the best of what we have to offer. How else to hear these words from Koch? We will explore. We will build. We will build ships. We will visit again. We will construct science outposts. We will drive rovers. We will do radio astronomy. We will found companies. We will bolster industry. We will inspire. But ultimately, we will always choose Earth. We will always choose each other. As Lovell looked down at the Earth in 1968, an old saying popped into his head, I hope to go to heaven when I die. Then he realized, I actually went to heaven when I was born. There is something disoriented, horrible, and somehow fitting in the timing of all of this, that one man with the means to do it would threaten destruction of a part of our planet at the same moment its beauty and fragility are on full display. We are in this tense moment, living with our own overview effect. Four are watching from afar. But the rest of us are watching too, left to reckon with our own place on the pale blue dot, reminded of all the ways we might die, and all the reasons for which to live. Next, Will People Ever Stop Eating Animals? By Andrew Zaleski. Through gestures big and small, Bruce Friedrich conforms to the archetype of a lifelong anti-meat crusader. He bikes almost everywhere. He was once arrested for streaking in front of Buckingham Palace with the web address GoVeg, GOVEG.com, painted across his body. He runs a Washington, D.C. nonprofit, the Good Food Institute, that champions alternative proteins and doles out grants to accelerate their development. And he is a dutiful vegan whom I have witnessed scraping the cheese from the patty of an Impossible Whopper. Yet he is also a savvy observer of popular trends, as you can tell from the opening pages of his new book, Meat, How the Next Agricultural Revolution Will Transform Humanity's Favorite Food and Our Future. From the start, Friedrich recognizes that the human diet is stubbornly carnivorous, perhaps even trending in what he considers to be the wrong direction. But he has traded in provocation for the soft sell. "I'm not here to tell anyone what to eat," he writes. "This book isn't about policing your plate." Friedrich's thesis appears in a chapter titled "Humanity's Favorite Food." To address society's insatiable craving for animal meat, we merely have to produce it differently. This includes plant-based options such as Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods, as well as the cultivated cuisine being generated by companies such as Upside Foods. Meat grown from animal cells in bioreactors resembling the fermentation tanks at your local craft brewery. Recall Winston Churchill's wish that humans would, quote, "escape the absurdity of growing a whole chicken in order to eat the breast or wing, by growing these parts separately under a suitable medium," end quote. Friedrich is a rationalist to the core. "Meat is absolutely not a diet change book," he told me over email. "And to the degree it has a stance on meat, that's pro-meat. It just suggests a shift in how meat is produced." Friedrich meticulously marshals figures in his book to explain the predicament. "Animal agriculture is the chief driver of methane and nitrous oxide emissions. Yet the world is on pace to produce more than 370 million metric tons of meat a year. Given the current trajectory, we'll require another 3.3 billion hectares of land over the next several decades to house all the livestock, a scenario that imperils the planet's remaining forests. Producing and promoting meat alternatives is, in his framing, an easy choice. If only we lived in a moment when measured arguments led to lasting technocratic solutions. The ascendant mindset isn't exactly moving Friedrich's way. Under the leadership of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his Make America Healthy Again movement, raw milk is trendy, and slaughterhouse meat now sits at the top of the food pyramid. The data on the popularity of meat substitutes aren't especially forgiving either. Sales of plant-based meat fell by 12% in 2023, a trend that continues. And this was before MAHA came to the fore. For lab-grown meat, the Good Food Institute's own recent survey showed that it appeals to just 21% of Americans. Can a supply-side leap in production fix this? Consider the comparison with a larger industry that has similar goals, alternative energy. Electric vehicles began growing in popularity a few years ago thanks to sustained investment and policies that begot social and cultural buy-in. These policies were dialed back, however, under the Trump administration, and sales of new EVs began falling again. Yet cultivated meat, still a relatively fringe innovation, isn't available to the everyday consumer. And plant-based meat, which you can find in grocery stores, isn't exactly flying off the shelves. Friedrich explains this trend with characteristically cheery forthrightness in his book. "The products are not good enough, and all of them cost too much. A gentle proselytizer, he has a habit of amiably conceding these shortcomings of meat substitutes before gathering himself back up to explain just how and why they will shortly be overcome. 15 years ago, no plant-based meat products even came close to the real thing. Now we have fast food burgers with imitation patties. Cultivated meat was once a scientific novelty. By 2023, you could order cultivated chicken at China Chilcano, the Jose Andres-owned restaurant in D.C. At times, meat reads like any other book, encouraging readers to eschew animal protein out of concern for the climate. Environmentalists and animal rights advocates have been trying for the better part of 50 years to persuade people, unlike Friedrich, to eat less of the stuff, or none at all. But Friedrich isn't trying to outdo Michael Pollan or Jonathan Safran Foer in rhetorical force or depth of research. Instead, what he sets out to accomplish, what feels new about this book, Meat, is to convince readers of a generational opportunity to replace like with like. Plant-based and cultivated meat that matches, in price and taste, the stuff under cellophane in supermarkets today. If these products can really catch on, a sustainable path may well be in sight. Replacing 50% of meat consumption with alternatives, a goal that feels aspirational, for now, would free up 650 million hectares of land. Friedrich writes, in conjunction with regenerative farming methods and carbon sequestration, that could be enough to move meat-related pollution far down the list of climate threats. We certainly have the means, thanks in part to Friedrich. In the decades since he founded the Good Food Institute, the alternative protein sector has grown into a business with billions of dollars in research funding, products that are approved for sale in the United States, and financial investment from Cargill and Tyson's Foods, two of America's three largest meat companies. This amounts to lasting progress. And yet, for there to be a way, there must be a will. The average American consumes more than 200 pounds of meat annually, and that amount is growing. Last year in this publication, Yasmin Tayang reported that America was experiencing a meat renaissance, adding, it's not just MAGA bros and MAHA moms who resist plant-based eating. A wide swath of the U.S. seems to be sending a clear message. Nobody should feel bad about eating meat. Cultural trends shift, of course, and what seems to stubbornly persist is an intrinsic discomfort with food that feels somehow inauthentic, and therefore viscerally wrong. Maybe they can solve all this eventually and create products people will want to eat, Marion Nestle, a professor emerita of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU told me, of Friedrich and his compatriots. But in general, as far as I can tell, people want to eat real food. Friedrich tries to parry this point head on. He believes there's still a lot of work to be done in educating consumers on the fact that cultivated meat is real meat, just grown from the muscle and fat, taken from a grazing cow or a strutting chicken. He also addresses concerns that plant-based meat is, quote, ultra-processed, end quote, noting that it still contains less saturated fat and fewer calories than the real thing. Most effectively, he pulls analogies from the history of scientific innovation, including his favorite example, the automobile. In the early 20th century, more than 500 car companies went bust. Cars were hard to start. Cars broke down easily. Cars were expensive. They were even panned in 1906 by Woodrow Wilson, when he was the president of Princeton University, as a picture of the arrogance of wealth. Just 7 years later, following the release of Ford's Model T, more than 1 million cars were on New York City's streets. Nothing is going to be successful until it meets consumer needs, Friedrich told me, touching on the real problem. The gulf between consumers and meat alternatives, including lab-grown meat, lies in their taste, price, and inconvenience. Until those metrics align with what we already get from animal meat, the alternatives won't become mainstream. While acknowledging this, Friedrich highlights the ongoing research that's pushing alt-protein closer and closer to what we've come to expect. Will the meat we eat, so often intertwined with culture and politics, be changed only through persuasion on the basis of ethics, health, or novelty, as Friedrich writes? That's easy to him. The answer is no. We still have a long way to go, but the path forward is a lot more clear. He said, we'll need to produce new versions of humanity's favorite food that taste like humanity's favorite food, in a way that doesn't asset strip the planet in service of the dinner plate. Perhaps that feels like a tall order, but stranger things have happened. For our third story, we're going to go back to space, which is a very current event as I am recording this. This article is entitled The Most Beautiful Moment of the Artemis II Mission, written by Ross Anderson. The most moving image to emerge from the Artemis II mission has not been a snapshot of the moon or the Earth. The camera was instead pointed at the astronauts themselves, squeezed inside their tiny capsule. Christina Cook sat in the foreground, strapped into her chair. Only parts of the other three were visible. Jeremy Hansen, the Canadian, was talking to ground control, but also to an international live stream audience. Hansen said that the crew had spent part of yesterday morning looking out the window at the moon. The astronauts had seen an abundance of craters, including a few scars likely incurred about 4 billion years ago, when, during their shared childhood, the Earth and its satellite were both bombarded by asteroids. Many of the lunar dimples and round basins already have official names, but not all of them. Hansen said that the crew would like to propose a couple of new ones. Naming is a poetic act, and it can go wrong. Before Richard Nixon's 1972 announcement of a new spacecraft that would carry Americans to orbit more regularly, Peter Flanagan, his assistant, made the case that it ought to have an exciting name. Someone suggested Pegasus. Naming the program for a winged horse, a working animal that could fly to and fro, made sense, and it was a callback to the classical Greek grandeur of Gemini and Apollo. Flanagan liked Space Clipper and Star Lighter, but he warned against the space shuttle, Nixon's eventual choice, because to him that name connotated second-class travel. By emphasizing the routine nature of the cosmic jaunts that the new spacecraft would enable, it risked reminding people of their dreary commute. It robbed the shuttle's destination, the celestial realm, of mystique. For this mission that has just flown around the moon, and those that will succeed it, NASA picked a much more inspired name, better even than the one given to the agency's previous moon program more than half a century ago. Apollo was never quite right. It is a name of a sun god, an avatar of reason, order, and harmony. Artemis is a proper moon deity. As a wild forest huntress, she embodies the dreamier lunar qualities, the nighttime longing and magic. On Monday, while flying around the moon, the crew tried to live up to this elevated standard of naming. During their live stream, Hansen said that the crew hoped that a crater on the moon's far side might share the name of their spacecraft, Integrity. You can understand why they might have been feeling gratitude for the little vessel at that moment, in carrying them further from Earth than any humans had ever traveled. It had bested the Santa Maria, the HMS Endeavour, and every single one of the Apollo crew modules. For days, its thin walls had been the only thing separating their soft animal bodies from the lethal vacuum of space. Hansen said the second crater was especially meaningful to the crew. It was located close to the boundary line between the moon's near and far sides, and can be seen from Earth for part of the year. Hansen proposed that it be named for a departed loved one from their astronaut family. To his right was Reed Wiseman, the mission's commander, who in 2020 lost his wife, Carol, to a five-year battle with cancer. The couple's two daughters were teenagers at the time, and since then, he has raised them on his own. We would like to call it Carol, Hansen said of the crater. His voice cracked as he spelled it out. C-A-R-R-O-L-L. The astronauts wiped away tears, and all four of them floated to the top of the capsule in a group hug. An image of human tenderness beamed down to a planet that badly needed one. Wiseman is now on his way home to his daughters. The crew blasted off from the Atlantic coast, but on Friday they will splash down in the Pacific. They'll don entry suits and Point Integrity's heat shield at Earth's fast-approaching atmosphere. The friction and burn will surround them in a placenta of superheated plasma. When it nears 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, the astronauts will lose contact with ground control. Parachutes will shoot out of the spacecraft to slow it down and stabilize it. According to NASA, the fabric will have been packed tight to the density of oak wood. The capsule will splash down off the coast of San Diego, and orange airbags will inflate to flip it upright. Divers from the U.S. Navy will approach in choppers and quickly set up a platform. Someone will slide open the capsule's door, and the astronauts will come out and huff down sweet lungfuls of sea air. I'm sorry, that last article was a bit hard for me to read without choking up a bit. We have run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to join us next time. I hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.